phone line today. We have the Chicago region. So thank you very much for joining on the call. The New York region covers New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Fairfield County, Connecticut. If you're from west than there and you're on this call, congratulations. You're in the Chicago region. It's huge. But yes, so I work at the British Consulate here in New York, and I'm accompanied by Diane, who has been our leader in terms of the Marshall Program for quite a long period of time.
Yes, I've been not only the chair of the committee for the last 5 years, but I've also worked on the Marshall Commission for 8 years in the UK, so I'm pretty familiar with the program and hopefully can answer any questions you have. And welcome again to all of the fellowship advisors who have dialed in. Thank you so much for your time this morning. We really appreciate it. We're hoping to be joined by the fantastic Faiza Massoud, who is the first ever Marshall Scholar winner from CUNY Hunter. And we're also hoping to be joined by the exceptional Emma Morgan Bennett, who is a recent Morgan Scholar Marshall Scholarship winner from Swarthmore University. So I love that these two scholars are joining us because they show that first-time winners do happen. Schools who haven't won before, please do continue sending us your candidates. And for the smaller liberal arts schools, I know sometimes there's a perception that it's tougher for you to win. You do also win. You send us fantastic candidates as well. So thank you for all the work that you do and the amazing people that you send us through the application process. We really do appreciate it.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Diane. So in terms of if you have any questions, because it would be quite difficult to do it over a line because, amusingly, we put all the money into giving scholarships. We don't give it on to our technicals, unfortunately. If you could text me if you have any questions on 917-893-0389, undoubtedly questions will come up during the time. I'll just repeat the number again, 917-893-0389. What I'm going to do is that so this is the third year in a row that we've done this teleconference, and I'm sure that a fair few of you have been on most of, if not all of those calls. So what we're going to do is I'm going to take us through an overview, but I'm going to do it much quicker than I have the previous couple of years. But first I'm going to show you where you can download the previous couple of years if I've rushed over something and you'd like to get a little bit more information. The first thing you need to do is to go onto the Marshall Scholarships website, which is www.marshallscholarship.org. And once you are there, and I'll just give you 30 seconds to get yourselves there, because the website is actually really good, and it's a really interesting way to navigate through a lot of different ways of looking at what course you should do, finding the rules. And there's actually, I found out today, a really good page on how to, that just for advisors that they can read. It's like only a few hundred words, and it covers everything that I think you need to know for a basic. We're going to go straight through there. So now that if you're on that website, what you need to do is you need to click on the word up the top. You'll see the scholarship apply study in the UK. If you could click on apply, and then you can click on information for advisors. And then you will come down and you'll see that there's two sections. Now there's information on the Marshall Scholarship. That's where we're going. But first, I want you just, if you could just click into outreach. If you click into outreach, you will see that there's some advice from the New York region for all Marshall contacts for the 2020 competition and the 2019 competition. So for the 2020 competition, it was what we did in 2019 for the Marshalls who are going to start in 2020. So this is for the 2021 competition that we are talking about here. So the applications which will get put in September, October, and or September, sorry, and that they will start in 2021. But if you then go back and we'll go and have a look in the apply and then information on the Marshall Scholarship. To be perfectly honest, first thing you'll see is Faiza's on the screen, which I find is a hilarious link to what we're currently doing today. Right in front of number 10 Downing Street, which is where the Prime Minister lives. And to be honest, you could probably just read straight down there if you wanted a quick overview of what the Marshall Scholarship is about. It finances young Americans of high ability to study for a degree in the United Kingdom. It's at each, about up to 50 scholars each year, we might have to raise that soon, are selected to do graduate study at a UK institution of any field of study. From the New York region last year, we selected, was it 8 or 9? It was 9 last year.
And it was 9 because we have a special funding mechanism through the Annenberg Foundation. And because of that, we were allocated 8 scholarships via the British government funding. And every few years, we get an extra scholarship because of the funding we received from the Annenberg Foundation. Mm. So we got a 9th scholarship last year.
Excellent. So the program objectives is to bring distinguished young Americans to come and study in the UK. And the basic information which we have of the program is that the subject you can study is almost unrestricted. You can't do an MBA, you can't do undergraduate coursework, but that's pretty much it in terms of the thing. You can go online and look at, there's a couple of other very particular courses, but in reality, you can study almost anything. You can't study a medical degree. You can study medical sciences, so it plays in there. It's open only to US citizens, so no DACA, who at the time of the scholarship, they're US citizens at the time they take up the scholarship, and they hold their first degree from an accredited US four-year college or university. You cannot apply for the degree if you hold a British degree or degree equivalent qualification. Study abroad is okay. It's a great scholarship. It covers uni fees, cost of living expenses, book grants, blah, 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 up to 50 awarded annually. Generally, it's a two-year program in terms of what people do. That sometimes students do a two-year master's. It's quite common for students to do 2 one-year masters and to split it over 2 different universities. There is also a one-year Marshall Scholarship program where students can do a one-year master's, but you have to be particular about how long the program is. It has to be at least 10 months, Diana?
Yeah. Yes, yes. I was part of the commission when we created the one-year scholarship, and our concern for the one-year scholarship, and for the fellowship advisors on the line, please note this. The one-year scholarship program was created for a very specific reason, and it was for scholars who are on a path to somewhere and really just don't have the time to spend 2 years in the UK studying. So this is not meant to be a gap year. This is not for students who don't know what they want to do and figure, well, I can go do a master's degree for free in the UK for a year, and that will help me figure out what my long-term plans are. This is really for people who are in the military, who are short on time, for people who have been accepted into PhD programs or med school programs or law school programs, but who really could benefit from having a year in the UK. Now, the reason why we don't allow the 9-month programs, the shorter programs, is because we want these students to really immerse themselves in UK culture. And 9 months really isn't enough time. We want them to spend as much time as possible and preferably full 12-month programs, which is why we restrict the programs. So we're looking for people who have very specific goals for why they want to be in the UK, very specific purposes for the programs that they've chosen. In their ambassadorial statements, they should be telling us exactly what they hope to gain from the time spent and how they will spend their time engaging with the broader public. So the one-year program is something we're very serious about, but we're looking for a very specific candidate for it. We get questions all the time about, oh, you know, you don't get very many of them. Is it worth sending a candidate through? Yeah, if you've got the right candidate, send it through. If you've got a candidate who's just thinking about it as a way to kill a year, please don't send them.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Diane. The other thing which I'd just like to cover is if you go up to apply in the Marshall Scholarship thing and you go across to regional committees this time, you can see how the regional committees break down in terms of where students can apply for. So students are allowed to apply for where their permanent residence is, i.e. usually where their parents live, or where the university is located. Now, you can see a map that is quite there, and I've just sent a message to Mary Daniel, who's in charge of our person. It's like, we have to make that map right, because if there's anyone who's from the UP in Michigan, it's a lovely place, I've been up there, I'm sorry, you're not coloured, but you are in the Chicago region, and Long Island has disappeared, which is a concern, because that's where I live. But ignore the map, and if you go down, you can see below that it's well listed out in which region each university would be located. And you can see that if your student does not want to apply in the region you're from, like New York or Chicago, they may want to apply from elsewhere in terms of what they're doing.
We always get the question around, is there an advantage to where I apply? Should I apply in one region versus another? There really isn't any advantage to which region that you apply to. The number of scholarships, we look at how many applications have each region received over a course of a number of years. We look at how many they've given over a course of a number of years, and it's proportional. So in terms of proportionality, the New York region gives a certain number of scholarships per the number of application received. It's the same proportion as Boston, Chicago, etc. So there's no advantage in terms of your candidate has a better chance of getting a scholarship if they apply to one region or another. They have the same odds no matter what region they apply to.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Dan. So I'm going to try and go and pick up Pfizer. So my question to leave with you whilst you thing is, the Marshall Scholarship is going through some changes this year. Not significant changes, but we always know it's the small ones which get people interested. Could you just run through what the changes are this year from the previous year?
Sure. One of the things that changed last year was the way that applications were submitted through the online system. And the deadline was split so that students had an earlier deadline at the end of September to submit their materials in the system. And then fellowship advisors had a slightly later deadline at the beginning of October to get all of the materials submitted to us with the nomination letter attached. That is something we will continue this year. I don't have the exact dates for the two different deadlines. That they will be on the website soon, hopefully. I know that the application should be going live sometime at the beginning of May, and the deadlines will be announced at that point as well. So just so you're aware, we will continue to have that split deadline moving forward, at least through this year. I know some advisors didn't like it. I understand the reasons for that. But for the schools who students look at websites and they say, oh, but the website says the deadline is here, it doesn't leave the fellowship advisors enough time to attach materials and get things sent through. So that's the main reason why we do that. You know, as advisors, you are absolutely free. If you want to set an earlier deadline for your students to submit materials to you, please do that. I know I used to do that as a fellowship advisor, and my deadline was the one that ruled everything, not what was published on a website. So you're free within your internal processes to do what you like, but for practicality's sake, there will be a student deadline and a fellowship advisor deadline published. Now, some changes that will be made to the application this year. Even though our criteria will remain the same, so we have our criteria around academic merit, leadership potential, and ambassadorial potential, and the sub-bullets within those remain unchanged. The application, however, is going to change a little bit. And some of the things that will be noticeable, in the beginning of the application, we ask the student about, it's kind of boilerplate that they're filling in their names, their birth dates, etc. And then we ask about paid employment, unpaid employment, any personal interests, etc., foreign travel. And in those areas, we're now going to be asking students to provide dates for when they provided these things. We're pushing this material back to more of a CV format rather than leaving it free form. What we were finding was that students were providing us with lovely essays about things we were doing, but we had no idea if they were doing it for a week or for 2 years. So we really do need this material in an easier to read format and with dates and more information about how involved the student actually was in the activities. The next thing that's going to change just slightly, the leadership prompt, we keep playing with this, and it's because we find that candidates are still not talking about the leadership activities they undertake with regard to our leadership criteria. So the leadership prompt is going to change a little bit. We're still asking candidates to talk about a situation where they worked with a group of people and recognized and responded to a need for leadership. And we're now telling them the objective of this is to help the committee understand the candidate's leadership conviction and drive, their style and potential, rather than providing a list of achievements or things that don't link to our leadership criteria. Now, just as a heads up, we see a lot of students writing about teaching experiences, mentorship experiences, on-the-job experiences, that they're just talking about something that was part of their jobs. These are not great examples for the leadership essay. Please do read our leadership criteria. We are looking at things like, how has a student delivered results? How have they carried an activity from start to finish? What strength of purpose have they had? And when we talk about strength of purpose, we do mean, you know, have they had to overcome obstacles to get to where they've gone to? Have they had some sort of continuity in the types of activities that they've undertaken and how they relate to that person's career goals? So please do have your students really read through our criteria and give us examples of things that link to these criteria. Now, teaching and mentoring are fantastic experiences, and quite often they link to our ambassadorship criteria. So please do make sure, as your students are writing the ambassadorship program criteria or essay, that they're talking about those activities. Now, the next thing that's going to change, we ask a question about the student's future plans. And this is kind of the I want to be this when I grow up answer. This used to be a 300-word answer. It's now going to be a 150-word answer. We've shortened this very intentionally because what was happening was in the prompt for the future plans, we were asking about how will your time in the UK help you achieve that? And what we were seeing was a lot of duplication of the answer to the ambassadorial question. So what we'd really like is have them focus on, you know, here are my future plans. Here's why time spent in the UK will help me achieve it, without going into a lot of detail about all the extracurricular stuff they'll do in the UK. Save that for the ambassadorial essay. The other thing that we're changing this year is the personal statement, which used to be 1,000 words. We're now shortening that to 750 words. There are a few reasons for this. Last year, we know you were crunched. Everybody was crunched for deadlines. We were seeing a lot of essays that were just, they dropped their Fulbright essay or their Rhodes essay into their Marshall application. And we know this because the closing paragraph said, I'll be a fantastic Fulbright scholar because, you know, and as my readers are reading this, you know, we understand that this happens sometimes with recommendation letters and the students don't have control of that. the students do have control of their personal statements, and it does not work in their favor when they're telling us they're going to be a great candidate for another scholarship. We know they're applying to other things, but please write your Marshall Scholarship essay for your Marshall Scholarship. The other thing is that because we ask so many other questions, you know, and questions that are linked to our selection criteria, we realize the personal statement doesn't need to be as long as it is. So, you know, students are telling us a lot about themselves in other parts of the essay, so we'd like the personal statement to be a little bit shorter, a little bit sharper. Tell us really what's compelling about you as a candidate. Why do you meet our criteria? What motivates and drives you? Leave out a lot of the fancy imagery and the fancy rhetoric and the, you know, I birthed a baby on a hill stories. We don't want to see that in your personal essay. It's not material that really helps us select you. I know a lot of fellowship advisors ask about distance traveled, and sometimes that is what comes out through the personal essay. So please do talk about that. One of the things that I've heard, though, that I would like to nip in the bud is people talking about playing up your trauma. You're not writing about your trauma enough in your personal statement. We are a merit-based scholarship program. We understand that students have had difficult experiences in their background. That is not why we're selecting students. And if students are uncomfortable telling us about their personal experiences, they do not need to be writing about that in their personal statements. You know, we don't want students being forced to express things that they're not comfortable writing on paper. So, you know, please don't pressure your students to write in that vein if they're not comfortable doing it, if they don't want to share those things with us. Andrew, well, I'll go back to you. Those are the big changes for this year. So I'll go back to Andrew now that Faiz is in the room.
Thank you very much, Diane.
You're welcome.
It's always interesting to hear, like, it's as much the thought behind the changes, I think, is just as important. Because I think that sometimes you can just hear about changes and understand what we're trying to do. But I think that comes well. Faiza, thank you very much for joining us today and
it's
coming.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Come here. So we have Faiza and we have Emma on the line. Thank you, Emma, for persisting eating on the line. I'm sorry if other people have had trouble to connect on.
I've heard
there's been some problems. No, it's nice to have you on, Emma. I'll come to you second, but first I'll come to Faiza. Faiza, so we just wanted to, you've just come back from 2 years in the UK as
right.
a Marshall Scholar. I just wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about your overall experience, what it was like, and what bits you enjoyed. And Faiza just sent a message to me of if I talk too long, stop me. So I like the fact that our Marshall Scholar who's here wants to talk about so many good things that we can't stop
it.
So that's
good.
There's
a lot to talk about. So hi everyone, I'm Faiza, and so I just came back from the UK a few months ago. I was studying at SOAS in London, and I did an MA in Islamic Law and an MA in Islamic Studies there. And what was the highlight for me, honestly, one was my school. I loved SOAS. SOAS is a school that is very different. They're very radical in many ways. So they're all about decolonizing academia, which I personally felt a huge affinity towards, especially in my field. Also, I just loved being immersed in a very international school. So my classmates were mostly British, but my school and the SOAS dorm that I was staying in was filled with students from all over the world. And those students are now my best friends and I'm still in contact with. They're from India, Jordan, all around Europe. And I learned so much just worldly knowledge just from that experience and getting to talk to so many different people. Aside from that, one huge benefit of being a Marshall Scholar is that you get to travel through the Marshall Scholarship. You get opportunities to travel with your Marshall cohort. We went to Northern Ireland, Manchester, Leeds. I traveled with my Marshall, like with my Marshall friends to Oxford and Cambridge and saw all like different types of universities and got to attend conferences at Exeter University, for example, and kind of see that campus and that little town, which I really enjoyed. And the great thing about the UK is that every single city is very particular and very different, and there's so much to explore. And I thought nothing could compare to New York City, but there's really so much to see. And I can honestly say that it does compete with New York City in the amount of things that there are to do and the experiences that you can have.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Faiza, for your detailed profile. We'll get you on the Tourism UK line very soon as well in terms of after that. Emma, now we're reaching out to you. My general question was asking what. So you've just won the Marshall Scholarship. You will start in the fall of this year. The first main question is asking what you're most looking forward to with the Marshall Scholarship program. But I think also considering your interesting story, maybe you'd like to tell us about where you were when you found out that you'd won the Marshall Scholarship in terms of how that played out.
Yeah. So I think the Marshall Scholarship is literally just a dream that I get more and more excited as I'm getting closer to finally going to the UK. I'll be in London next year as well. And so I'm on the volleyball team. And so when I got the call from the Marshall Committee, I was actually in the middle of taking an ice bath. So I was in, you know, 50-degree water, and suddenly my phone was ringing, and I was like, who is this number? And it was just a very, very hilarious moment of screaming and lots of joy and definitely a lot of shivering. So I didn't stop shaking probably for, like, the next 2 hours, but it was definitely something I'll never forget.
Emma, can I ask you, I had the pleasure of meeting you at your interview, reading all of your materials. For the fellowship advisors out there, for any of the candidates out there who are listening in, I found your background and your leadership statement and where I talked about earlier in the call, the strength of purpose. I found your strength of purpose unbelievably compelling. Can you tell the group that's listening right now a little bit about what you're hoping to achieve through the Marshall Scholarship and in your career, and how your background supports that, and a little bit about the leadership essay that you wrote?
Yeah, of course. I think that what really, so I do a lot of things. I go to Swarthmore College, and I do a couple of things that have really been long demonstrated, like, commitments for me. So one of them is that I'm a doula, so I support pregnant women during their pregnancies and births. But that work has also, like, deeply tied into my thesis, which is in my anthropology department, and then also ties into my work on campus, which has basically resulted in a club on SWAT's campus that trains doulas in particularly anti-racist doula work and how to support marginalized clients in the surrounding area, since we're quite close to Philadelphia. But then I also do a lot of extensive work surrounding diversity and inclusion within my athletics department. And so I think for me and my leadership statement and in trying to understand how the Marshall would guide me in my next couple of steps as I'm leaving college, for me, diversity, inclusion, looking at how we can really centralize marginalized voices, but also really develop these spaces for joy, that has been the continuous line for my own style of leadership. So making sure that we're not only, focused on conversations of oppression and marginalization, but really trying to carve out intentional spaces of radical joy and radical community. And so that was something that I particularly wanted to show, that my leadership comes out and is most strong. And so whereas some others, I think, probably opt towards, like, talking about student government positions in student government or in officer roles at their university, I was really invested in just showing my particular perspectives of and also ways of community building that I've had long-term demonstrated interest in at Swarthmore. I hope that helps.
No, Emma, thank you. It does, because you were a great example of, as you said, you didn't have this, I wasn't the president of student government, but you made tremendous impact in the communities that you worked with, both at Swarthmore campus and outside of campus. I also have to say, you are probably one of the only personal statements that I've ever read that started with birthing a baby, where that story actually made sense to me. So thank you for that. Can I switch over to Faiza really quickly too? Because Faiza, I've had the joy of interviewing both these wonderful women. Faiza was another person who, through her leadership work, and I've actually had the pleasure of, through the reports that Faiza sends back as a Marshall Scholar, witnessing how Faiza's leadership work, she's also carried over into the UK. So can you talk a little bit about that, Faiza, in terms of what made you appealing to us as a candidate, and then how did you also carry that through as a Marshall Scholar in the UK?
Definitely. So I think my leadership abilities that I showed in my application kind of went into also the ambassadorial role that I hope to play in the UK and kind of strengthen the relationship between the UK and the US, which is one of the goals of the Marshall Scholarship. So what I had written in my application was that I hope to continue my interfaith work in the UK. So while I was an undergraduate student at Hunter College, I had started Hunter's first interfaith club, and it was actually the first interfaith club in any CUNY school. And after I had started it students from other CUNY schools, meaning City University of New York schools, had contacted me saying that they wanted to do the same on their campuses. And so I was personally, as someone who's studying religion and Islam, I am passionate about interfaith. So the club that I started in my undergrad actually used techniques from Cambridge University. So that kind of tied me already to the UK. And I knew that when I went to the UK, I wanted to continue that interfaith work, especially I got the Marshall Scholarship in 2017. And my interview for the Marshall Scholarship was the day that Donald Trump was elected. And I remember emphasizing in my interview that the UK and the US are facing very similar conflict and struggle, in that both are faced with a brunt of this rise of anti-immigrants, anti-Muslim hate and rhetoric, especially given, you know, the Trump campaign that was kind of based on that, like, anti-immigrant rhetoric, as well as the Brexit campaign. So for me, I felt that interfaith work was so much more important and urgent at that time, especially. So when I went to the UK, I was very lucky to be able to be part of the interfaith scene. One, in London, I, besides attending various interfaith events with Coexist London, I also was a speaker for Marylebone churches and synagogues interfaith event. So I was their Muslim speaker, and it was the first time that I was a speaker at an interfaith event, and it was specifically at a scriptural reasoning event, which is the technique that was founded in the UK to do interfaith. So that was really empowering for me to be able to use this technique that I used in my college in the US in the UK. And it was kind of like, it was so fulfilling because this technique had been founded in the UK itself. And then also I was able to take part in Cambridge's scriptural reasoning conference for 2 summers while I was a Marshall Scholar. So I was chosen to write a paper for Cambridge University and take part in their interfaith work amongst Cambridge's faculty members and professors from all over the world, actually, who were studying religion and doing interfaith work in their own countries. And so I was very lucky to be able to continue that interfaith work and learn about the similar struggles that the British were facing, that the Americans were also facing, you know, post-Brexit, you know, post the Brexit vote and post-Trump election. And it was really enlightening to be able to talk about that across the pond and cross borders.
Thank you very much, Faiza. So I think we will, the piece that we've always had each year in terms of is Diane talking through the selection criteria, partnership schools, and choosing a university. The main reason that Diane also keeps getting pushed into doing this is that she sort of wrote the selection criteria, so she has to try and justify her work, I think, in this part of the sitting. So Diane, we've gone over this twice. So it is there in a couple of different forms that we can see in the previous thing. Is there anything that you'd want to add, list, or highlight in terms of the work that we've done? Also, we can hear there's a fair bit of static on the line. If you could please mute your phones if possible. And if you have any questions, please do feel free to text me. Again, the number I will take questions on is 917-893-0389. Thank you very much. Diane.
That's okay. I'm pulling up the selection criteria as we speak, just because I do always need a little bit of a reminder on on what they are. You know, one of the things that we go through over and over again with the selection criteria is the leadership, because we do find people still aren't getting a good feel for that. As I said, I'm going to run through those really quickly just because we've been on that topic with our two guests and our two scholars who have been here. But one of the things that we're looking for, delivery of results. Can you actually tell us what changed as you have been involved in something? A strength of purpose. We talked about that. Can you take something from start to finish? Can you demonstrate in your overall academic career or in your overall extracurriculars that the work you've been doing is in support of the career that you want to undertake? Creativity and problem solving. Can you look at a problem or an issue and come at it from a different approach? Can you show us why that approach was necessary? So again, when we're talking about people who have held student government roles, yes, that looks like a leadership role, but if all you've done is keep things ticking over and haven't done any differently from your predecessor, then you're not really showing us a creativity and problem solving. We've included especially the creativity and problem solving because we know we get people from lots of different backgrounds. And again, this is a great criteria, a bit of the criteria for people from science and engineering backgrounds to talk about, because again, they're solving problems day in and day out. How are you doing something differently? Why are you doing it differently? One of my favorite engineering candidates actually created a knee joint that instead of having 2 degrees of freedom has 3 degrees of freedom. So that way, instead of just bending back and forth, it can swing in so that people from developing countries can sit cross-legged, which is important to their cultures. They quite often will sit cross-legged on the ground. You know, he showed a real creativity both in terms of understanding the culture and in putting forward an engineering solution to address it. So these are the things we're looking at with regard to creativity and problem solving. The last sub-bullet in the leadership is self-awareness. Now, this isn't something that we've really talked about, but I think both Faiza and Emma demonstrate this great self-awareness. You know, Emma very clearly said, this is why my leadership style is different. Faiza too. You know, we know that they understand what their role was in the activities they did, how their leadership style has evolved over time, or what they possess that makes them a good leader or that makes them a different leader. And so we want to see that your students understand how they impact other people, how the things that they do and the things that they demonstrate enable them to solve problems and bring people along with them. So for students who are writing in the we voice, please change that. Make sure they're talking about I and my role in something and how I've impacted people. Okay, so I'm going to go off of the leadership criteria and onto the academic criteria. The one thing I always say with the academic criteria is, other than the 3.7 GPA, we do not have any criteria around your student's GPA. Period. End of story. We award to students who have 3.7s. We award to students who have 4.0s. So please don't put any sort of fake GPA cutoff within your internal system, because if you're telling your students they have to have a 3.8 to be able to apply to the Marshall Scholarship, you're probably losing a good candidate who had a 3.7. What we're looking at with the academic criteria, we're looking at the program of study. Have they chosen a program that makes sense for the career path they're on? And to enable people to understand the programs of study in the UK, the team in London have put forward a selection tool on the website where you can go in, you can actually search for different topics. It will pull up the different UK programs, and you can compare and contrast the different UK programs. So, you know, we are looking for people who understand, you know, why have I picked the University of York to do chemistry? Why have I picked, the University of Cambridge to do math and science? Why have I picked SOAS to do Islam studies and law studies? So we are expecting the students to pick the best program for their field and for their career path. So this is why we offer partnership schools. This is why we hope students will consider schools outside of UK, you know, outside of Oxford, Cambridge, and LSE. These are schools that have great programs, but there are schools that are better suited in certain disciplines for other programs. So we're looking at that. We're looking at the overall UK knowledge in terms of why study in the UK, what does the UK add to my studies, to my career path. So we're looking for that broader, here's what's compelling me to study in the UK, along with here's why I've picked this school. Then we're looking at the overall preparedness of the student to undertake their graduate studies. So we're looking in depth at the transcript, the undergraduate courses that have been taken, any sort of undergraduate research, publishing. For creative fields, we're looking at any sort of exhibitions or any sort of audience creation that they've made. We're looking at these sorts of things to make sure that the student is ready to undertake graduate studies in the programs that they've chosen. Quite often, we will look at the program and say, actually, this student doesn't meet the basic eligibility criteria. So as your students are picking programs, make sure that they and you are looking for the eligibility criteria, because if they're not eligible for the program, then that's a big negative on their application. The last thing we're looking at are recommendations. Oh, and I forgot to mention, sorry, one of the biggest changes we're making to the application this year is we are now only asking for 3 letters of recommendation.
Yes.
Yeah, Andrew's laughing at me. It's like, that's the biggest thing you guys needed to know, and I forgot it. We're only asking for 3 letters of recommendation. So we're still looking for the one lead recommender who is a good, solid overview of the candidate, their academics, their career path, the things that they want to do, why the UK is a good place. We're asking for a second letter that's a more general academic letter in support of the candidate and their graduate abilities. And then the third letter should be, will remain more of a leadership style letter to talk about some of the extracurriculars and the candidate's ability to lead and to solve problems.
Could I actually interrupt there? Because there's a couple of questions right on this point. So while we're here, we may as well go this. I think because with three, not four, there's a sort of changes. Because someone was asking about order of letter, whether the most prestigious person needs to have the first letter. But there's only three letters, it sort of changes the way it works. They're also asking whether there should be letters from outside the university, and I presume the answer is yes, especially if it's relevant for the leadership essay.
There is still going to be that lead letter. The student will still have to recommend which letter is the letter that will get read first. And again, that should be kind of the strongest, most well-rounded letter. Then from there, if people want to have recommenders from outside the university, that's absolutely fine. Make sure that the letter writer understands our criteria and can be addressing our criteria and how the candidate meets our criteria, but they don't have to all be from the student's university. We often see students who will have done studies elsewhere or who will have done research elsewhere. That's really relevant to their career. So, make sure your students are picking their best and strongest letter writers. And where Andrew used the word prestigious, the prestigious is the first letter writer. I'm going to correct that slightly in that we're not looking for who's the biggest name in the letter writer. It is who's writing that best, strongest, all-around letter. It doesn't have to be from a big name person. It's really who does know that student the best and can really play them up in that first letter. So Andrew has just left the room for a minute. So I'm gonna move away from, can I move away from the letter of recommendations, Andrew? He's just returned.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm gonna move away from the academic criteria and onto the ambassadorial criteria. The students will still have to write that ambassadorial essay as that last part of their application. And there are four sub-bullets under the ambassadorial criteria. And with this, I always tell students, don't think about ambassadorship as I will be a diplomat someday. That is not at all what we're looking for. If you look at our criteria, what we're looking for is, do they understand the US-UK relationship in their field? And is there some form of need for them to be working in the UK or having ties to the UK? Both Faiza and Emma are great examples of this. Emma is hoping to do work looking at mortality of minority groups and groups that haven't had fantastic access to healthcare or who don't necessarily respond to traditional forms of healthcare. And so she is looking at issues that are very similar in the UK as they are to the US. They are being handled very differently in the UK than they are in the US. And so for her to be a leader in this field, it makes complete sense for her to be going and studying there, getting her hands, dirty on the ground, making networks, building contacts, bringing things back to the US and having that long-term relationship. She's not going to be a diplomat in any political sense, but she will be a diplomat in her field or have an ambassadorial role in her field. And that's the sort of thing we want to see people talking about in their applications. The next thing we're looking for, do the students have extracurricular activities that are relevant and that they can undertake in the UK? And Faiza talked through a great example of how she has done that. So we're looking for things that students will be able to, that they've done in the US, that they've spent time doing in the US, they'll carry over, and it will help them meet regular people in the UK, meet British citizens, meet people, talk to them about issues. Hopefully there'll be some tie to the career, but it doesn't necessarily have to be so. We just want them to get that broader knowledge of the UK. The third thing we're looking for is what sort of interpersonal skills do your students have? Now, this is a hard one sometimes for people to put on paper, and this is something that we do test in the interview. So again, when we talk about the interview, quite often we will be asking questions that are difficult to answer, that there are no right answers, just to see how the student responds. So again, you need to make sure your students are ready to talk to us, ready to talk about big questions, ready to be put on the spot a little bit, not because we're trying to gotcha, but because we want to make sure that they can talk to wide varieties of people. They can talk to people outside their peer groups. They can hold up under questioning, and be a good representative of the US and be a good representative within their field. The last thing we're looking for is that students can seize opportunities. We're looking to see that they can go out into the UK and make things happen for themselves. Hopefully they have done this on campus. When we see students who everything they've done has been a predetermined or a pre-existing event on campus, sometimes it makes us wonder, can they do things outside their comfort zone? So, we know not every student has the opportunity to join groups. Are they creating things on their own? Are they finding their jobs on their own? Sometimes in interviews we'll ask, how did you get that summer job? Have students be prepared to answer that, because what we're testing is, can they go out and make things happen on their own? And that's what we're looking for within the ambassadorial criteria.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Diane. So I think that what I do now is probably I'll throw back to both Emma first, because over to Pfizer. Just advice that you could give in terms of, so we talked a bit about putting together the application, maybe the interview as well, in terms of, is there any advice that you would want to give to the candidates as to how to better prepare for the interview? How do you fake it until you make it, in terms of as being ready in terms of your interview, in terms of your work? So Emma, have you got any views or ideas?
Yeah, I think that for me, I was definitely anxious about the interview going in, just because I knew how competitive the whole process was. And I actually ended up watching the video that you guys had posted about what the interview process was, and that really helps alleviate a little bit of my anxiety. And I think the best, and I know how cliche it sounds, but like the best advice I can give is really that the Marshall Committee and all of the interviewers really did seem invested and like excited to hear about all of the initiatives that I was engaged in and all of the things that I was doing. So it was really just about quickly relaxing in that interview setting and just trying to have an exciting conversation. And I really just tried to be genuine in conveying what most excited me and what really got me going in terms of my own passions and interests. So for me, that ended up talking a lot about, you know, pregnancy, birth, and vaginas for 20 minutes. But that was what worked, because that was authentic and very genuine to my own character and my own style of leadership and all of these characters that you've been mentioning.
Wonderful. Thanks. Pfizer.
So, a few things. The anxiety before the interview is really real. And so, what helps for me, especially since, of course, this, like, short interview can literally change your life. So, I definitely was very nervous before the interview. So, what helped me was I took my sister along with me. I live in New York, so the interview was in New York, and my sister took the train ride with me to the UK consulate. And that helped a lot, just having someone with you. If you're someone who gets really stressed or feels anxiety before, you know, as anyone would before such a huge thing, I would suggest taking a buddy with you if you're traveling to your interview. Also, my school prepared me by having some mock interviews, and that really helped. If you don't have that support at your university, you know, find professors that you're close to and schedule a mock interview yourself. You can definitely do that. You can even ask your good friends to watch you and ask questions while you kind of answer mock questions that you know would probably come up in Marshall interviews. Also, I would recommend highly to read over your application before you go into the interview room, because you will be questioned on your application. Very specific things too. I remember being asked about a specific internship that I had done, and if I had not remembered that I put that on my application, then I would be totally taken off guard, because it was actually a very short internship that I did. Also, what really helped me was, in my mind, I had a list of about 5 things that I said, I have to mention these things in my interview no matter what. So I just mentioned that I was asked about an internship that I did, and it was a small internship. I didn't really have much to say about it. And I knew it was the last question of the interview, because the person who asked the question said, this is the last question. And I realized I did not talk about my interfaith work at all throughout the interview. So I redirected this final question about my internship that really didn't mean that much to me, because it was in my freshman year of undergrad, and it wasn't that important to what I hope to do in the UK. So I geared it towards my interfaith work. So if you have this list of like very important things that you feel like you have to mention to your interviewees, make sure you say it. No matter how you get it in there, try to get it in there if you can.
It's very interesting, actually, because the concept of the 5 things being something that's very important. One of the senior people who's actually a part of the panel has talked about interview advice here, and it's very much, yeah, make sure you get your 5 things out. So that concept very much plays through. Oh, can I just one brief thing in terms of my suggestion on anxiety. So one of the issues which we've had is that I tell people to arrive 15 minutes before their interview, and some people like to arrive significantly earlier than that. Can I strongly recommend that you don't advise students to do that, for one reason? I think that if students come early, they meet other students. And funnily enough, I think students get a bit overawed when they meet other students. You're all wonderful,
But you meet someone who's a little different from you in a little bit different view area, and I think your inferiority complex set in because, yeah, not to, but I've had multiple people sitting down for long periods in a small area outside, and we couldn't separate them. So, well, amusingly, I walked out, I was like, I better separate these people, and they're all chatting. It's like, well, it's too late for that. But I think I think it's a case of don't try and get them to reach out to other students beforehand to try and make the connections. You're all wonderful. Stick in your own zone, stick in your own lane, and don't you don't get thrown off by other things. Diane,
I actually was just going to say the same thing as Andrew. We've had a couple instances where students have shown up not like 15 minutes early for the interview, but more than an hour early for the interview. And I have to be honest, those students do not do well in interview because by the time they get to the interview room, they've chit-chatted with everybody at the consulate. They've chit-chatted with everybody in all the other interviewers. They're very low energy by the time they get to us. So, you know, most of the interviews are taking place in some of the biggest and most beautiful cities in America. If they're that early, have them go wander around the block, have them go get a coffee. Do not have them sit in the lobby, please.
Yeah. There's a lovely coffee shop, a Japanese florist coffee shop just across the road from here, from the consulate, 48th and 2nd. You should definitely go and get it. But it was actually one of my points in the past. I once had a chat with a really wonderful student. We talked for ages about gender for 15 minutes, and then she went in and didn't get a scholarship, and it was like, oh, I hope I didn't, like, because we had such an engaging conversation, I was almost worried that maybe I wore her out a bit before we got into, I mean, you can't, I'm not going to, and that person did win a Rhodes, so I'm not going to lose too much for that, but it is something that you do worry about. Questions, I think. So I've got a range of different questions. We've got a few minutes. Feel free if you want to ask more questions. The number is 917-893-0389, 917-893-0389.
I'm going to address one that Andrew showed me while we were talking, in that someone has said that in their experiences, someone from a regional committee has told them that if the student doesn't have below a 3.9 or if they aren't Phi Beta Kappa, don't bother putting them forward for a Marshall scholarship. Regardless of what region you're in, we are all instructed to work in the same way. We do not assess based on GPA. So if a single member of a committee has said this, they are incorrect. It's not how the entire committee works. You know, we meet as committee chairs every year. We go through everything every year. So I would say, if regardless of what you've heard or what somebody has said off the cuff to you, the official line is you only need a 3.7. We award to students 3.7 and higher. Send your students in who are 3.7 and higher. Please don't put false GPA cutoffs on your candidates.
Diane, one of those good old classic questions. Should we discourage candidates from reapplying who didn't get an interview last year?
No. We love candidates who reapply. We do love candidates who reapply. We won't always re-interview them though. This year we did re-interview a few who reapplied. We didn't interview a few who reapplied. What we're looking to see is how has the candidate made their application stronger since we first saw that application. So some of the committee members will remember them, some of them won't. When they first go through the reading process, it's very likely that they're not being read by anybody who's ever seen them before. So for the first round of reading, it's like a fresh application. By the time they get to the interview committee, possibly one or two of the committee members, if not more, may actually recognize the candidate and remember meeting them from the past. So what we're looking for is to see how have they made significant improvements against our criteria and against what they want to do with their careers. Please do tell them to reapply, though. We always love seeing reapplications. We like seeing people who are that interested in studying in the UK.
Wonderful. Someone is asking about questions in terms of letters and recommenders. Could I recommend if you go under the apply section, there's an information for recommenders tab. There's a good amount of information there, which I think might be useful in terms of where you go there. Next question I'm going to throw to Faiza and Emma once I get my questions sorted. The question was, what advice do you give for crafting a strong application on the written side? So we talked about the interview. We've talked a bit about the, in terms of the strength of purpose, in terms of things. Is there anything else, I guess, you want to add? We'll go to Faiza first and then Emma if she wants to add anything.
Sure. So I think for me, what helped was, I think, my support system. So I had written a draft of my personal statement, and
I thought it was good, and then I let my family read it, and my sister, who knows me well. So one, have someone read your application who knows you well and knows your abilities and your writing abilities and your talents and knows your accomplishments. I had my sister read it, and she said, this is not good at all. Rewrite it. So I literally rewrote my personal statement, and mind you, my application process for the Marshall is very distinct and unique as well, because I found out about the Marshall Scholarship a month before the deadline for the application. So I was already pressed for time. And so that month that I had to write my application, I would not suggest anyone do this, but I worked for hours and days, and I made sure that I had people read it who really knew who I was and my potential, because only someone who knows who you are can say, this is not your best writing, and you are not describing yourself fully, and there's more to you. So have your professors read it. Have your friends read it. Also, I always, when I read letters of or personal statements from friends who are applying to the Marshall, I always emphasize that they should make it as personal as they can, or because that is your personal experience and why you are wanting to go to the UK, why you are studying what you are studying, why you're passionate about what you're passionate about is very distinct, and it has to do with your personal story and your narrative. So if you can include some personal bits about what led you to applying to the Marshall or studying what you're studying, that I think would have would make your application very unique and stand out and personal.
Emma?
So I think I have a very different approach for my own personal statement and written application. So I'm glad that we have two different manners of getting the same result. But for me, for me, what was important was both giving myself enough time to let my application sit. So I drafted my first version of the application fairly early, like as soon as the prompts came out, which I think was over the summer. I'm not sure, but I had already been thinking about personal statements and doing some drafts. And so then I let that really sit for a second. Didn't even look at it, and just kept on thinking about what are the consistent themes in my life, what are the points that I really want to bring forward to the table that can get people excited about interviewing me. And then I also would say that for me, at least, because I really look at the personal statement as something very intimate and intimately tied to like who I was, that I was very selective in terms of who I let read that personal statement. So I also chose people who, i.e. one mentor, and then also my parents, who are professors, they read my application draft, but it was more to see, again, see if like my writing was coherent, if my ideas were coming across, but I really wanted to stay rooted in my own story and my own application, so it wasn't about, I didn't want my application to then suddenly sound like it was being written by somebody else, because I didn't want that distance for if I got the interview, which I ultimately did.
Thank you very much, Emma. I think, well, firstly, maybe we should have an advertising service for Pfizer's sister to come and read through applications. But, related question, sorry, which I got asked a little bit this year, and I didn't know the answer. We allow fellowship advisors to read and have a look through the candidates' essays, whereas that's not done by other places, which I wasn't aware of, actually.
Yes. Unlike the Rhodes Scholarship, we do allow the fellowship advisors to give feedback on the application materials. If you are doing this, your scholars should not, or your students should not, be submitting their Marshall essays as their Rhodes essay. This will be less of a factor this year because our word counts are now different. So, but yeah, no, fellowship advisors can give feedback on the materials.
Wonderful. I should attempted to go to always the last question, but I should go to the first one, which was asked, which was about how do you treat applications from institutions who do not rank and give an information? They want to ask how that influences final decisions. What detail that the university could provide in the narrative, like saying, "Oh, we do not rank our students, but this like this student is still the, yeah." How could you help the university show that one candidate is better than another that wasn't, if you don't rank?
Where we've asked for students to tell us
kind of where the, I think this is at the end of the application where we're asking the schools
like it's like what where do you place the student? And some might say like top 10% or it's the top 1% of applications.
Right. Well, yeah, I was going to say we have very few schools who don't rank, so I don't really know how to answer that. Schools usually are able to give us some sense of how the candidate stacks up against other students, either within the department or overall within the school. So, you know, we kind of ask them to do that, and most of them do. So I don't really know how to answer that.
Sure. So a question for Faiza, and then I'll go to Emma first. Can you, because Diane's already, to be honest, I think given her side on it, but I think people will be interested in it. Can you speak more about articulating the US-UK relationship for the ambassador question? Is the academic disciplinary relationship or current social political relationship relevant or both? Well, clearly for Faiza, but yeah. Emma, do you have any views?
Yeah, for sure. That's a great question. So for me, I think, as Ayan mentioned, my work is particularly about Black women and their maternal morbidity rates. And so for me, I had to do my research. I had to understand how my particular research interest translated internationally, and not pretending that this situation was the same in the United States as the UK, but really saying there are some really important differences. There's a different role of the history of the slave trade in both of these different, in both of these different national histories. There's a different role of what percentage of Black women are dying in both of these countries. The UK has a significantly healthier Black population in terms of maternal mortality rates. And so I think for me, I was really trying to say that I've done my research. I know that there are cultural differences, healthcare differences, all of those types of things. And that's why this is so, that's why this scholarship is such an amazing opportunity, because I can't become a leader in my field unless I have that international framework and that international perspective. So that's what I got really excited about thinking about, and also really made sure that I emphasize that both in my written application, but also in my interview process, which is how I think that it's quite important to have an international and global perspective, especially when studying conversations about race and identity, because Blackness is Black people are not a monolith, and they are different in every environment and every country that we encounter them in. So that was something important for me to emphasize.
So, Faiza, on the ambassadorial question?
Sure. So, I kind of went into this before, how my interfaith work was really the way that I show that I would have an ambassadorial role in the UK. But aside from that, I think what someone who doesn't have something in mind or some action that they could take in that ambassadorial role in the UK, maybe you can think about something along the lines of your innate kind of qualities that could be useful if you were studying in the UK. For example, I'm not sure if I mentioned this in my application, but it was definitely something on my mind and probably mentioned in my interview. And it was that, you know, as a Pakistani American, a Muslim Pakistani American, I was very interested in kind of the experience of British Muslims in the UK. And kind of wanting to compare that to my experience in the U.S. And what was really interesting about the U.K. is that they have a much higher percent of South Asian Muslims in the U.K. than in the U.S. So being, you know, my ethnicity being South Asian, I felt like I was personally interested in that dynamic and I wanted to learn more about, you know, the South Asian Muslim experience. And so, and that was something that I actually talked about to so many people, because I actually was academically also driven and curious to know about that, the specific diasporic experience and the specific Muslim experience of South Asian Muslims in both the UK and the US. So that was something that I talked about with a number of South Asian Muslims in the UK on campus and elsewhere, And I think something like that is very important in building a strong relationship between people in the US and in the UK. And so your identity can be part of your, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, your ambassadorial potential.
Can I just chime in? Sorry, people asked, is it more important if it's kind of in the academic field versus the socio-political context? There really isn't a more important, less important. Do you have to have both? We're really looking at, do you understand how the US-UK relationship plays out in your field and will play out through your career? In some fields like the sciences, it's going to be a little bit less focused on the socio-political, although we have seen students who make a case for, you know, there are specific funding mechanisms at work in the UK that they want to understand as they're looking to put in place scientific partnerships across the US and the UK. So it's important for them to be there and working within certain programs. You know, in the arts, similarly, the way that the arts work is different in the UK quite often, but it's less about kind of a political context or socio-political context. It's really more understanding the field and the environment in the field. So what we want to see is that level of nuance. We don't expect everybody to have, there's a really strong political reason why I'm here in the UK. Again, it's not about kind of governmental diplomacy. It's about career and your field diplomacy and ambassadorship.
Excellent. I have one last question, then I'll ask a general goodbye question. The question that was asked was, what percentage of people have GPAs over 3.9 or other? I must admit, we don't track literally how many there are. We know that we have given marshals to people with 3.7s in the last year, and there's tons in 3.8s, and we interview a fair bit in 3.7s. In short, I just say it this way: if you discard everyone who's in your 3.7s and the 3.8s, you could be throwing out your Marshall Scholars. I've spoken to fellowship advisors who have had Marshall Scholars, and they've walked up to me afterwards and said, you know what, this person wasn't who I even thought was our best candidate, but our best candidate got nothing, and this candidate won a Marshall. So, I mean, don't premedicate too much in terms of what we're after, leave the field a bit more open. Maybe I'm trying to encourage to have more applications, but I think it's a more positive thing.
Yeah. Just to add to that, it makes it a very easy selection process if we say, oh, we're just going to take the top GPAs. We don't do that. We spend a lot of time and manpower reading through these applications. I mean, I have, I think, close to 40 volunteers who read applications with us. Yeah. You know, we've got a huge committee. They come from all different backgrounds. You know, it's almost a little offensive to me that people think, oh, it's all based on GPA. Mm. It really, really isn't. Mm. And I'll tell you something as well. And I say this every time we do one of these calls. I have seen schools and candidates do really interesting things to make sure their candidate has the highest GPA possible. They take all their science classes at summer school so that the grades don't count towards GPA, or they do them at study abroad so the grades don't count towards GPA. We get these tricks. So we're not that impressed sometimes with the 4.0s we see, whereas we are really impressed with the 3.7s we see from students who have taken graduate level courses or courses outside their field just because they were interested and thought they could learn something more from it. So we want to see, you know, we really do want to see the candidates that you think are the strongest. Please, please stop focusing so much on the GPA. I know we have, just because I looked through some of the applications that we've awarded to over the years. I know we have awarded to students who have had 3.7s. That's the only reason why I could tell you, is because I just looked at them. I very rarely look at the student's GPA when I'm assessing an application, because I know they hit the minimum. That's all they have to do.
Yeah. There was a related question here about ranking, whether the student had to be in the top 5% of the university. And again, No. Meet the GPA requirement and then show the wonderful skills which we have in Pfizer and Emma, and we'll give you a Marshall.
The ranking becomes more important, and one of the reasons why we started asking this is for schools who are sending us dozens of candidates, and all of them are the best things since sliced bread, all of the recommendation letters say they're at the top 1% of their class. We know if you're sending us that many students, they can't all be the best student ever. So it helps us to get a sense for how do they compare within a school? And that's why we ask for the ranking.
Excellent. I think we've gone through the questions. If anyone has any more, feel free to, you can text me on that number. I can always get in contact with the various people here, and I'm sure they're very happy to answer questions.